button and then, well, good morning, everyone. Nice to be here with you. And some of you have made it. You know, I know that in the United States, it is not easy to be here at this time. And you'd have to be sort of in the dead of night in South America also. So we've come to basically program number 25. Four of those programs I simply did as self-talk, but the other 21 programs, you have been here for them. And we have just finished a very comprehensive paragraph about time and about Earth years and about even the, you know, speculatively, even the duration of the universe. Of course, we have no idea really how to do that because we have the reincarnating soul of Logos is not part of the consideration of most scientists unless they happen to be theosophists as well. But it is sort of fun to take some of the poetic language about time and cycles elapsed and try to convert that into other durations, more exact durations. We do, the one figure that seems to stand out in all of this is the duration of a solar system as 311 trillion 40 billion years. And that's so far out of range with the normal considerations regarding our solar system that until there is an adjustment and a deeper understanding, well, we're just going to have to admit that the usual scientific position and the position of the Upanishads and the ancient Indian writings, probably taken from Atlantis at length, are just out of adjustment with each other. But that, whatever it is, we have a huge scope ahead of us. And that is a sufficient condition for us to have that sense of awe and inspiration regarding the kind of system in which we live. Just like to welcome you here, you know, always my gratitude here to Michael, who's keeping us on track, and welcome to you, and Annette, and Catherine, Cindy, Ishtar, Kim, Leslie, and Manish, I believe it is, Canodia, it looks like it, Mariut, Martine, Risto, Vera, and Zenaidi. And maybe, despite the hour, some others will join us along the way. So we have, we're kind of finishing up this footnote now that we have looked at some of the great spans of time. Let's see if I can. Yeah, I took this for you just to, you know, put it in context from page 1084 of the book much later, but also giving a tremendous idea of the cycles in which we are involved. Time spans so great that they turn out to be really functionally incomprehensible. Alice Bailey talked about her first, in her autobiography, she talked about her first exposure to theosophy through a lecture, and she was not really very happy with it. She was quite a dedicated Christian at the time, who believed that the Earth and maybe all the universe had been created in 4004 BC, and therefore that everything was about, roughly 6,000 years old. And she thought of the lecturer as delivering the rankest blasphemy, and she rejected it entirely. And of course, that shows you how you can be born in a different culture, less advanced than the one in which you had been working in previous times. Obviously, she was a strong disciple of K.H. and cooperated with D.K. in times gone by, but she was not awakened to that fact. And she was living within certain narrow forms based upon the culture and civilization into which she was born. So let us all hope that in our next incarnation, we wake up quickly. I'm trying to, well, I'll just have to let it pass. But, if we feel that sense of rebellion when we are young people, it may be because the environment in which we find ourselves is so terribly limited compared to what we have known in the past. I certainly found this to be the case for myself, but something rubs off, due to our parentage and the kind of culture in which we find ourselves, and maybe something quite necessary. And overall, the opportunity to pay some karma is presented to us. And we all know that with Saturn operative, karma can be very limiting. Of course, it can also be wide and full of opportunity. And some people are born into situations like that. But for many, you really have to face what you owe. And then when you are finally released from that, you're amazed at what you did not consider about the reality of life. This, I'll just read this, it just gives us the sense of scope. It's a lot different from Bishop Usher, I think his name was Usher, Irish bishop, in the more or less late Renaissance period, deciding that the earth was about earth and all things surrounding it was about 6,000 years old. Within the wheel, forming that wheel, are all the lesser wheels from the first to the 10th dimension. These, in their cyclic turn, hold in their spheres of force lesser and other and lesser wheels, yet many suns compose the cosmic one. Wheels within wheels, spheres within spheres, each pursues his course and attracts and rejects his brother, the law of attraction and repulsion, and yet cannot escape from the encircling arms of the mother, the kind of Mula Prakriti out of which all this arose. When the wheels of the fourth dimension, of which our sun is one, and all that is of lesser force and higher number, a hint there, such as the eighth and ninth degrees, turn upon themselves, devour each other, that's the law of synthesis, and turn and rend their mother, they break free of the sort of a material milieu matrix in which they have found themselves, then will the cosmic wheel be ready for a faster revolution? And by that, we may be talking about a solar systemic wheel, a cosmic logoic wheel, a super cosmic logoic wheel, a galaxy. There are other philosophical reasons why we probably should not think we're talking about the entire wheel of any particular universe. Maybe I won't get into that, but the whole idea of an infinitely involved finite universe is a contradiction. And that's what you'd have if the whole universal wheel forever increases. Every universal wheel would be an infinite wheel. But I won't get into that too much. It's just something to ponder. So we kind of ended there and returned to the footnote from the Bhagavad Gita. The universe is, you know, and I always like the indefinite article, a universe, because I think it's more accurate in terms of the ancient lore. The universe is formed, dissolved, and reproduced in an indeterminate succession. And that word indeterminate, I think, is very important. It's kind of a mathematical term. It means really an infinite, beginningless, endless succession. Each universe being of, should we say, virtually infinite duration, but not of truly infinite duration. I mean, you know, for our particular time sense, it just may seem to go on and on infinitely. And I don't know why I'm so kind of taken by that word, but I think people are often very imprecise, mathematically imprecise in the use of the word infinite. When I say it, I try to use it correctly as much as is within my power to do so. So here I just call it virtually infinite because of our very, very limited time sense as microscopic man. And I say here, may we say that we have plenty of time, all the time in the world, and yet no time at all, because it probably in the ultimate sense does not even exist, just the way space does not. Once you have eliminated the reality of sequence and eliminated the reality of interval. There are so many mysteries, I think, in the mathematical key to the secret doctrine, and we'll be choosing our key, or maybe our particular key is already chosen, and we just have to rediscover it. There's a lot of discussion as to whether these huge figures are literal or symbolical, and arguments can be made on either side. So if they are literal, how is it that the various periods are tied to the method of keeping time as practiced on Earth? Maybe it's just because we have to be somewhat geocentric, or we completely lose our bearings. And we do have a kind of a revolutionary period of 1 year that in the ageless wisdom, that 1 year is considered the same number of degrees in a circle, 360, and the 5, 365 is discarded as unwieldy. It's not. It may be actual in a certain sense, but it's not mathematically useful. So if they are symbolical, how then can the ancient literature speak of a kalpa as astronomically determined, that is, time elapsing between successive conjunctions of all planets, presumably major planets, within the orbit of Saturn, in the first degree of Aries. So, you know, that argument, are we dealing with symbolism? Are we dealing with literality? We'll just have to be aware that there is an argument, and we'll have to defer it until we know still more about time and space. Already, we've made a huge jump. I mean, Newtonian time and space suffered greatly as a concept when Einstein came along with his flexible time and space, we might say, and it's been somewhat proved that he was correct. So what kind of system are we living in anyway? And I've said here that it's questionable whether there exists computer software which can calculate whether or not such conjunctions even happen, but maybe the computing power for an expert who is really, really interested in this would be sufficient. Okay, now returning then to the ray of intelligent activity, that's on page 39, I think, looks like it. Okay. Okay, and then just going into page 40, we were just at the very end. It embodies the basic vibration of this solar system and is its great internal fire, animating and vitalizing the whole and penetrating from the center to the periphery. It is the cause of rotary motion and therefore of the spheroidal forms of all that exists. Now, you know, that's a generalized statement because he does tell us that there are three kinds of causal bodies. There are the spheroidal type. One does not know the proportions, okay? Then there are the ovoid types, and then there are the elongated types. And I wouldn't be surprised, you know, we've got a basic kind of one, two, three there. I wouldn't be surprised if the shapes of causal bodies are connected with the ray of the causal body. And you kind of wonder if the ray of the causal body changes, maybe for some, at least one time in the duration of human history, whether the shape of the causal body also changes at that point. It's something that comes into my thought. So the foundational ray here is really the ray of the previous major solar system. Remember that all in all, we will have six literal solar systems with a seventh somehow being outside of time and space as the summation of all the six, sort of the hidden point, the hidden system within all the six. How that works, well, let's do our best one day to find out. You know, sometimes there are just mysteries here and we just can't go too far with them, maybe an occasional speculation. But, you know, what DK oftentimes does when summing things, he gives you at first the literal appearance, and then he takes the wholeness or the several instances which are coming together. Let's say he takes etheric, physical, astral, mental. Those are specific instances of elemental expression, and then he sums the whole thing the three together make a fourth. And that's that one's easy to understand. That is a personality. It also can be applied to the six solar systems. The six together in some way make a seventh solar system, because he does talk about sometimes the seventh solar system. But you get the idea that it appears as a summation of the previous six and may not be a literal system at all. Now, you know, probably the study of a little bit of music, as DK has shown in some of his books, you know, the chord of the monad and so forth, the perfect third of the personality and the fifth of the soul and the higher octave of the monad, probably that's somewhat important in the new esoteric schools. So even if you're not a musician, you might get yourself a pitch pipe, you know, or maybe you have a keyboard or something like that. And you can see how musically the different energies are working out, the different notes representing zodiacal signs and representing planets. I'm not going to get into all that right now. I have elsewhere gotten into it. And I will produce for your consumption a paper on esoteric musical notation and correspondences. And, you know, it's not a long paper, and I think maybe you'll find it to be useful. But if you have a little keyboard, or if you have a pitch pipe, it will be more meaningful to you. And if you can reproduce a tone when you hear a tone, as not everybody can, you'll be able to sing it, and you'll be able to get the sense of how these different notes and intervals work to represent the vehicles and principles of man. So anyway, for our purposes and at this time, and regarding the major solar systems, we don't really know too much about the strictly physical, strictly astral, strictly mental solar system. See, one of the things that's important to realize is that in the lower mental body, which produces what we call the mind, we also have the location of the personality as a mental entity. So when we're dealing with a solar system, which is the third solar system, but not the third major, just simply in a sequence, the third or mental solar system, when we get to the fourth system, we're also dealing with the lower mind, because on the level, maybe I can show something here. You know, I'll try to remember to actually do it so you can see it, you know, which means actually pressing the right button. The mind, the lower mind, is focused on these lower four levels, but so is the personality, focused around the mental unit. And so the summation of the physical permanent atom, astral permanent atom, mental unit all take place on the lower mental plane, and there's a summation in a fourth unit of the three that have gone by. Now, why am I bringing that up? Well, maybe I'll remember in just a minute. It has to do with what is the basic note of our solar system. And basically, if we begin on the note, well, we can begin on any note we want. Usually, note number, the red note C, or the indigo note A. Interesting that orchestras, at least in the West, tune to various frequencies of the A. So it's the note Fa. And when we use the solfeggio system in music, we use that note Fa to represent the personality, okay? Even as the note Mi, M-I, represents the mental body, but also other things like the buddhic vehicle. So it goes, Do, Re, Mi, Fa, Dum, Pum, Pum, Pum. So that's from the red to the green note, and they are complementary. The Do is considered the red note, and the Fa is considered the green note, and it represents the basis, or the basic vibration of our particular solar system. We are working on a different note now, but what went before was the establishment of the personality. And really, the previous solar system, major solar system, was not the opportunity to create initiation and the union of soul and personality. Maybe in some cases it was, but so often it simply, simply established the personality. And as we know from studying the Dweller on the Threshold a little bit in the glamour work we are doing, that dweller can be quite independent of soul influence or of noticeable soul influence. So whatever that F or Fa frequency is, and that all depends on, you know, finding a really, really accurate note on which you can base all the other frequencies, it is foundational. It's the note of the Holy Spirit, and sometimes it's called the note of the Mother. I would just say that to distinguish the Holy Spirit from the Mother is not an easy thing to do, but a hint exists in the following way. And that hint would be that the physical plane is divided into an etheric portion and a dense physical portion. And so when you take the entire solar or systemic or normal planar physical aspect, it's etheric and physical. And what I'm beginning to think may be the possibility is because of that division, the three is a four. In other words, the etheric aspect of the physical plane represents more of the Holy Spirit, and the more condensed aspect represents more the denser physical material, and that can be associated with the Mother, which is the fourth in one way and part of the third in another way. So anyway, this basic vibration of the solar system is causing a lot of trouble right now, because, or at least we're having trouble with it, because we have not adapted to the the soul nature of the Soul of Logos, which has to master the basic note, the F note. We haven't adapted sufficiently yet. And the result is, if I may say, a contest between the note G, which is one of the major notes in our present soul solar system, and the note F, which is mental personal. And that's causing a lot of war. That's causing conflict. That's causing the battle between love and materialism. And it's going on right now. There are some people who are addicted to the fa, to the green, to the basic note, and have not made the transition into the soul note of our solar logos, which is going to be looked at if we begin the scale on the note C. It's going to be a G. So in other words, the contest going on right now is between these two notes. The F is strongly established, and the G is not yet as established as it must be. And that's exactly the issue going on our planet, not only in the solar system, but on our planet particularly, with its second ray soul, which is the G, and its third ray personality, which is an F. So those are just some of the little musical tidbits regarding the musical key to the secret doctrine and the kind of frequency battle that we are experiencing on our planet, yes, but in a more general way in our particular solar system. And when, if I may say, the note G completely dominates on our planet, and when the note G completely dominates in the solar system, we will have a sacred planet, and we will have a sacred solar system, which it is not yet. See, Sirius may be a sacred solar system, but we don't live in one yet. So the third ray is causing the vortex, and it's kind of Fohat-like. It digs holes in space. And I think if we use our imagination, we can understand how that vorticular motion is going to create a kind of isolated sphericity, if you will. Isolated sphericity. I'm going to try to get this spelling correct. Maybe it's not, I'm just going to make it correct. Vorticular. So now we come to the equivalence. See, certain kind of motion of certain kind of items in cosmos reach out to other items and begin to coalesce and even to create a unity. But there is a type of isolation that is caused by strictly vorticular third ray motion. And it basically, you know, people joke about it, but they say, you're in your own world. You know, you usually say, you're in your own world with a D. But they say, you're in your own world. And that means you're going round and round, emphasizing your individualism, and you're not really relating. Well, we need the second ray in order to really begin to relate to our fellow vortices, you might say. Now, some of the equivalents of terms might be this, that Fohat and Brahma are really identical. And the third ray and Fohat can be considered to be the fiery whirlwind, you know, which is really in a way the Holy Spirit and its manifestation. And we can see that this rotary motion is built up by this whirling upon its own axis, but it's not really all that communicative. You need to get the second ray into the picture and its type of spiral cyclic motion before there is real communication between the vortices. Now, this idea of the periphery is raised, and periphery is interesting. It always relates to the third ray. I mean, for instance, if you have a kind of a peach or a fruit or something, the outer skin of it is related to the third ray, the pulp is related to the second ray, and the seed, which can regenerate, is related to the first ray. And in the, there's a note here from the Pranavavada, and it tells us that he who covers up, envelops, surrounds, and undertakes all, so that's a lot of activity, right, is Brahma. And you have the idea of Fohat as being this tremendously active cosmic whirlwind, kind of the great ever-busy electrical actor in the cosmos. And of course, it filters all the way down to people. You can see the third-ray people, one type at least of them, just rushing around from here to there and not creating too much order, basically simply demonstrating their activity. Let's see if there's anything else to say about this. Basically, we're working here on the idea that the basic vibration of the solar system is a great internal fire, animating and vitalizing the whole and penetrating from the center to the periphery. It's the cause of rotary motion and therefore of the, you know, largely spheroidal form of all that exists, with some exceptions, okay? Now, different things emerge. There is a theory that there is no karma from one universe to the next, not from one solar system to the next, or one galaxy to the next, but from one universe to the next, and that each universe offers a fresh start, uncomplicated by karmic residues, okay? And that the implications of that are very interesting. Basically, it has to do with a completely new creation, universally considered, but within the universe, karma prevails. And, you know, there are reasons for that, and basically it well, no, I can't get into that, but there are reasons for that. Okay, if this theory is correct, then there is, at the close of every universe, a universal redemption and the complete fulfillment of the grand design or purpose for that universe. After all, how long does a universe last? Well, maybe long enough to get the job done, because you can't have any hangovers in the super universal state. Everything has to be cleared, as it were. The end of the universe is a great clearinghouse. And why we consider that there are no residues from one universe to the next? Yes, there are residues from one lesser intra-universal system, like a galaxy, let's say, to another. But finally, the great archetype is fulfilled. After all, who's saying you can have only so much time? And that's a question, does the great breath breathe regularly, entirely? Or does it breathe according to necessity? Now, we're into a symbolic kind of question there, and maybe one day we will know the units of years or whatever measure we use that distinguish the inhalation and exhalation of the great breath. Even as we don't necessarily have an entirely regular breath, but can control it, holding our breath longer or being in the exhalated state longer, so we have to presume that the same is true of the great breath. All right, so basically what we have there is we went back to the ray of intelligent activity, and we tried to understand that it is the master, at least in our solar system here, it is the mastery of this ray and on our planet that will take us into the major theme of this second major solar system, where we will begin to sound the note sol, S-O-L, in the solfeggio system. You know, if you're a musician, they have this solfeggio system where they attach certain syllables to certain notes in the scale. Some people are really expert at this. They were trained in that way, and I always marveled how they knew where do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do, where they were. And they could just sing out any piece of music in the solfeggio system. But basically, the musically considered, the entire process is linked to what we call a cadence, cadence, C-A-D-E-N-C-E, in music. You start with do, you go to fa, you go to sol, and back to do. And you'll recognize that that's how a lot of pieces of music begin and end. I'll give you an example in my terrible morning voice here. Tum, 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 tum. Do, fa, sol, do. And you find that at the end of so many pieces of music. It's somehow the whole story of any entity, and even our solar system, and maybe even much greater entities, from the do to the fa to the sol and back to the do. Or you, if you want to raise the vibration with a similar effect, tum, 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 tum. So you've gone to the octave. Do, sol, do, fa, sol, do. And you recognize that da, tum, ta, tum is an octave and basically the same note at double the frequency. Well, all of this has a lot to do with why the fourth ray is called the ray of mathematical exactitude. Mathematical exactitude. Because these frequencies have to be rightly adjusted to each other in order for the divine plan to work out in accordance with the divine purpose. Look, I could, you know, skip over this stuff. I, you know, just jump over it and not pay too much attention to the depth of it all. But that's not what this particular little, if I can call it a class, that's not what it's about. It's about going into the whole thing with depth. And so even though we move slowly, there will be depth. And maybe we can learn how to literally think deeply instead of just gloss, you know, like a glossary, glossing over things as if we understand them and race on to the next thing. We can have a different attitude whereby we really begin to discover deeper relations between things. Now, you know, as I've kind of said and maybe joked a little bit, that what we're doing here in Cosmic Fire is the science of relations, okay? And there, in occultism, there's just so many relations that we can study with meticulous entirety. And in our identify as being, I joke and I say, and here we're studying the science of non-relations, where ordinary knowledge no longer applies, and where finally the goal is to get rid of all relationship. Now think about that for a minute. Right now, we want to have all the particulars of relationship. But when we're in identify as being, we want to dispose of relationship. And as I've often said, it's not what you are, it's that you are at all. That's what we're trying to zero in on the, you know, kind of inquiry like we had yesterday morning. Not what you are, that would be the realm of quality. And in a way, who cares when you're doing that kind of work, who cares what you are? It's the very fact of your being, that you are at all, which is the main focus of our inquiry. So as I've often said, parallel lines of inquiry, each of which is necessary. Okay, so we did like one paragraph. Okay, well, that's just how it goes. The commentary on there, and then we'll get into intelligent love. And basically the most interesting part of the whole book here, maybe 1,000 pages, maybe 1,000 pages in this 1,200 and something, 1,283, whatever number of pages, maybe 1,000 pages is given to the ray of intelligent love. And so therefore it's of greater moment to us than the other foundational fire by friction and the electric fire coming later. And you can be sure that as we study along, we're going to learn a lot in the great science of relations. So this will be for the next time, and here we will have on the 14th, and it'll be a PM time. And still, of course, page 39. All right. Now, if you're thoroughly confused, then I've done my job. Well, not, you know, I'm joking again, but we have to put up with initial confusion about things, and we'll work our way into a kind of clarity that goes along with a special articulated synthesis of all those things. And DK says, well, it ought to hold you for one spiritual generation, this book, but how long is a spiritual generation? that he never really did say. Okay, so then if you'd be so kind, if you have any thoughts or questions, this would be the time when we're going to attend to them. And Michael, you can, there may be utter deafening silence for a long time, or there may be something that people would like to say.
I'm looking, yes, I'm looking for hands, and I'm looking for comments and questions placed into the chat box.
Okay. So that's what you would do, folks. You'd put your comments or questions into the chat box, or you'd raise your hand so that you can speak out loud and we'll attend to what you have to say. Sometimes I stop before the hour is up because I don't want to take up a new subject when the present subject is so rich. It would just cause, you know, unnecessary sense of doing things halfway, you know.
Oh, here's a good question. Thank you, Nicole. What does the universe comprise of?
Any universe is, well, of course, who's going to answer that, okay? But any universe is the objectification of a tiny portion of infinite possibility. Any universe is the objectification. In other words, the venturing forth into finitude of a tiny portion of infinite possibility. So basically, the universe is being, and it is the finitization of being, and the self. It's a perception. The universe is a self perception of the one who is. In this particular case, that temporarily finite one is the universal logos. So the universe is a self-perception of a portion of the content of absolute infinity as viewed by the by a universal logos. In other words, if the logos of the entire universe stops perceiving itself and all the potential contained within itself, then with the ending of that self-perception, the universe ends as well. So basically, pralaya is the ending of self-perception by the universal logos. And all the things in it that we say, hey, those things are out there, and there are atoms, and there are molecules, and there are cells, and there are kingdoms, and there are worlds, and all of that. That's all contained within the a finite, limited, bounded being of the one great being. In other words, you're the one great being that is super universal is shoved forth into finite isolation, but within it are various potentials extracted from absolute infinitude. And when the universal logos looks upon itself and sees those potentials and begins a process of perceptual self-reduction. Now, that's a really important idea. it begins to see less and less of itself, less and less of itself, then the universe, as we know a universe, comes into being. Otherwise, it would just be one great being seeing the entirety of itself and not in any detail. It would just get the sense of being the bounded one. So from the unbounded, absolute, super universal infinity comes the bounded universal logos, a finite being who contains certain potentials. And when those potentials are self-seen, then the universe appears. So what can you be conscious of except yourself, really? What it really boils down to, there's nothing else. So the universe, universal logos, has only itself to be aware of, and that self-awareness produces what we normally call a universe. Now, of course, I couldn't write all that down, but I hope you kind of get the idea. The universe is self-perceptual. Any universe is self-perceptual. And without self-perception, there is no universe.
Michael.
Yep.
Nicole is bringing it closer to home.
Uh-oh.
To be more precise, are we talking about the one about whom naught may be said, i.e. the seven solar systems?
No. No. We're talking about the universal logos, which is so far beyond the one about whom our local one about whom naught may be said, as to entirely make that one about whom naught may be said absolutely minuscule. However, such beings as a one about whom naught may be said, let me go over here and grab a hold of a one about whom naught may be said. such beings are absolutely a, here, this green triangle, that's a one about whom naught may be said. And there are 49 of them here in our local vicinity, and this is not even a galaxy, of which there are trillions. These ones about whom naught may be said are emanations of the one and only universal logos who prevails at any one time. Now later, we can eliminate time altogether, and we can prove basically that there is no great breath, there is no interval, there is no time, there is no space. You know, we can come pretty close to having all that be a consideration, a serious consideration. But for the moment, the one about whom naught may be said, as huge as it may be when compared to our tiny planet and local suns, is a minuscule emanation within the economy, within the system of the of any universal logos. So you know, there's big, and there's bigger, and there's biggest, and then we're going to find out something else that is really shocking. Is that the finite system of a universal logos is actually an absolute infinitesimal. Now, in the other class, I'm going to get into that about what is an absolute infinitesimal. And we will discover that all perceptions are absolute infinitesimals, and there's only one in all cosmos, and only one absolute infinitesimal in the series, in the endless, beginningless, endless series of universes which we have apparently had. There's only one absolute infinitesimal out of all of those infinite, apparently infinitesimals. Now you get into math here, and it's not exactly the science of relations as DK presents it, because we're close to home and we want to know what's going on in our planet, in our solar system, in our local cosmos, and in the unknown that we call the one about whom naught may be said, page 293 of Cosmic Fire. We want to know that. And we don't know what's going on in the galaxy, really, you know, subjectively. But we want to go as far as DK has been able to take us. You see, these masters, they know the names of a bunch of galaxies, maybe 49, and what the quality of each galaxy may be. That is hinted around page 1084 of Cosmic Fire. But we don't know anything like that at all. And we want to be able to just manage our tiny little microscopic lives so that what we call the divine plan can manifest on the material level. That's what we want, and that's legitimate. But at the same time, in order to stimulate the higher mind and really get into what it is and get into the universality of intuition, we have to think in these broader terms, using what DK calls the transcendental mind. Now, probably none of us can really do that, but we're learning how to use the transcendental mind to detect pure reason on the Buddhic plane, which will give us the key to the science of relations. So then, going back to the original question, the one about whom not may be said is a tiny emanation.
Michael.
Yeah.
Vera's hand is raised. Vera, you can unmute yourself.
Yes, I did. The time scale and the prior. So in terms of our solar system, between the first solar system and the second solar system, was there some sort of systemic pralaya?
Yes.
All planets disintegrated and then they had to manifest again?
Yes. Yes. And as a matter of fact, the big question there, It's a huge figure between successive solar systems. And the question is the figure regular, like 311 trillion years, or are you dealing with a tightening spiral? Now, just imagine that you've got a kind of cone, you know, like the wizard's hat, let's just say. And we have cycles that are climbing that wizard's hat. They tighten and tighten and tighten so that they take place more and more rapidly.
Yeah.
So it's possible. And, you know, I can't answer the question, of course, but I can say what we can speculate upon. It's possible that the pralaya between disintegrated and reappearing solar systems is ever less. And who knows the figures? Or sometimes DK seems to say, and the same thing would be true of rounds in chains or of rounds in scheme chains between chains. In other words, the spiral might tighten.
Yes.
And that is the way our life tends to be, and then our own perception of time is altered accordingly. So we get the psychological sense that things are moving faster. And then in the early days when we're, you know, still pretty non-responsive, that things move slower. But there's also hints that that, let's say, in a chain round, about 311 trillion year, no, well, what can I say, 300 million years occur, and that it is consistent. So I would say one of the problems to solve is how big is the interval between incarnations of these great beings. And look, you know, DK says, oh, you think you know, you know, Theosophists came up with all kinds of things. If you're developed this far, you're X number of years between lives. And if you're developed that far, you're Y or Z, you know, as if you could make it somehow a formula. And DK says, no, you cannot make it a formula. There is variation. And so if there, you know, all the way from maybe 3 years to 300 to 3,000, I mean, you know, if a human being can have that kind of variation between incarnations, and somehow we apply this to larger beings, this flexibility, mm-hmm. then there's not the regularity we might otherwise suspect. But the basic answer is yes, there is a pralayic period between reappearances of great entities, including galaxies, constellations, suns, especially solar logoi, planets, and yeah. and our particular planet, how many incarnations have we had? Maybe this too is our fifth incarnation of the Earth scheme in relation to our solar logos. And maybe too, we are in the sole solar system, or the sole incarnation of our planetary logos, and before it was much just more personal, getting the personality in order. And maybe the next incarnation, and we'll be there for that, will be a will incarnation. And, you know, it will be have a very important function within our reincarnating solar logos, who will probably have, in my view anyway, a first-ray personality. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in short, intervals, apparently, yes. How long? It's a huge subject.
So, do we have some inkling when was our Earth's last pralaya?
Yes, in the last solar system.
Last solar system.
In the last major solar system, because in a way, we are an extension of our solar logos.
Yes.
So when the solar logos last incarnated in a major system, Earth was there, fulfilling some kind of function. Actually, we are a base of the spine center. Now, how long ago was that solar system? How long, you know, and there, that's a big problem, because some people measuring the duration of a solar system say Blavatsky's figures are much too big. And other people say, no, they're just right. And Blavatsky herself says, no, they're just right. And then a very long period between solar systems would exist. Because don't forget, you've got to deal with all that goes on the inner planes. And maybe the time scale on the outer plane is the very fastest and most rapid yeah. of all the time scales. And inwardly, things really stretch out. I can give you an analogy with regard to initiations, that it's like an hourglass in a way, you know. In the beginning, the history of man is long. Then you go through initiations, yeah. 2, 3, 4, 5, zip. Mm-hmm. And then with initiations 6, 7, 8, 9, the hourglass expands again. And much, much longer time is taken. As a matter of fact, you're going to spend just the rest of your kind of career as a member of the fourth creative hierarchy, you're going to spend that as a monad, which has a huge expanse of time connected mm-hmm. with it. So the hourglass figure is useful, I think, when talking about changes of duration in the initiatory or just the normal growth process of the human being. Now, maybe every time you say something about the human being, you've got to think, but is this true also of the planet? Is it true of the solar logos? Is it true of the cosmic logos? How far does the analogy hold? Mm-hmm. At least we have the habit of analogical thinking, which DK says is the great interpretive method. So look, you know, frankly, we don't know these things about the great science of cycles, not yet, but we're getting a little hint piece by piece by piece, and we will know more when we are masters, but not nearly enough. our knowledge of cycles will continue to grow.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Vera.
Michael, Nicole continues, please explain the seven cosmic logoi on the cosmic monadic plane. Confused.
On the cosmic monadic plane, those are beings about whom nothing is said. You know, they're really, really ones about whom naught may be said. And if you turn to page 293 in your cosmic fire book, you're going to see that a solar logos has planets as chakras. Cosmic logos has solar logoi as chakras. A one about whom naught may be said has constellations of solar logoi as chakras. And the kind of being that is here about which nothing is said, and I simply call it a sub-parabrahmic logos, has ones about whom naught may be said as chakras. So maybe in this, you know, we don't have charts that are big enough to maybe show everything here, but in one of these sub-parabrahmic logoi, our particular one about whom naught may be said may serve the function of a throat center. And in that throat center, many constellations will be found, and sub-constellations and solar logoi and so forth, just the way in our own chakras, it will have a lot of little divisions. So when you're looking at the cosmic monadic plane, you're not even looking at one of the final dimensions of the universe, not at all. We haven't even gotten to the galactic level yet. What is this being? A cosmic parabrahm. Look at the indefinite article there, not the cosmic parabrahm, but a cosmic parabrahm, which is basically a type of being that we might be able to represent on this particular chart. Let me show you, you know, it's from the Theosophist, but wait a second, I've got to find it, you know. Maybe over here. Yeah, that's the one, the next one. See, now, I don't know how high this thing goes, but maybe on some of those very high levels, we may have cosmic planes, each one of which contains the whole chart on Master DK's page 344 that we've just been looking at. So, you know, it's like, you know, Russian dolls and Chinese boxes and all that, things within things. within things. And if you think that you're looking at the whole universe when you see this thing, it's just a little bit of it. I don't know what dimension we could call it, but we have cosmic planes here, and the whole diagram is of the super cosmic etheric physical plane. In other words, all of these cosmic planes are like subplanes, and then the whole picture is just the etheric physical plane of a super cosmic logos. And on, how far, we don't know, it goes, but we've got to at least reach the galactic level. And as you begin to understand how big galaxies can be, you know, I mean, galaxies with 6 trillion stars, I read the other day, maybe more sometimes. DK has only given us a very tiny bit, not even at the galactic level yet, and it's already too much for us to really understand. This is the kind of thing to understand the one about whom naught may be said, to understand a sub-parabrahmic logos like one of these, is something that solar logoi would have to address themselves to as they are trying to advance. So, you know, really, if we just keep the scale straight, I don't think, you know, we have to become too confused about it. I would say that, yeah, we're not going to really understand what we're looking at, but we're going to get the sense of ever-increasing scale, which includes entities we probably never heard of before. And I don't know any place where DK discusses these sub-parabrahmic logoi, or where he discusses a cosmic parabrahm, such as may be found somewhere on this theosophical chart. But you see how the seven keep resolving into the one, into the one, into the one, and it takes you pretty high and beyond anything but the mind. You know, the mind has a concept, but as far as practicality goes, we've just got to get our psychological nature straightened out right down here, get our astral body working properly, get our mental body held in the light. You know, it's very humble what we have to do, even as we're speculating about these vast reaches in the emanation program of our universal logos.
And there are no more questions or comments placed in the chat box, and no hands raised at this point.
Okay. You know, what I'd have to say, this book, Cosmic Fire, it's written for the initiate consciousness. So it's in a way, you know, it's got to be written for a consciousness that is beyond us and far, far beyond the consciousness of even the average intelligent, esoterically trained reader. And you might wonder why DK wrote all this down when it's so far beyond Bishop Usher and the 6000 and 404 BC, 4004 BC. And let's just say that the mind of many human beings who even consider themselves intelligent is very cramped. It's very crunched, you know, it's very concrete. It's nowhere near reality. So basically what DK is doing in a book like this is he's dissolving all those concretions in the great abstract thoughts. And then he's trying to also invoke our intuition into a true sense of universality, because when we study what intuition really is, you know, in the beginning of Glamour, A World Problem, it has everything to do with universality, with universal love, with identification. It's not just like, oh, I got that one right, you know. It's not like a psychic hunch. It's something much more. So he's trying to, basically, DK is training us to stimulate our higher faculties that will be found on the higher mental plane, on the Buddhic plane, on the Atmic plane, and beyond that, you know, there's nothing mentioned because it's just too far beyond us. So it's not only the facts that are important that he's trying to teach us about, it's what it does to our mind. If it makes of us real abstract thinkers. And don't forget, for the next 2,000 years, that's going to be the emphasis. Subrace 6 of the fifth root race puts an emphasis upon the abstract mind before the intuition can really be cultivated in the sixth root race, which is kind of imminent, really, and will last 10 million years. See, there's that hourglass again, Vera. You know, Lemuria lasts a long time. Atlantis, quite a bit less. The Aryan dispensation, the fifth root race, very short by comparison. We've only been at it a million years, and it's just about ready to give way into what? Into a sixth root race that's going to last 10 million years. And what about the seventh root race? See, so the hourglass is, that analogy is holding. So right now, a book like Cosmic Fire is going to stimulate our ability to think abstractly. And what I really try to emphasize is that to think abstractly is not the same thing as to think in a complicated manner about concrete things. I want to make sure that I'm understood on that point, that we can have a lot of concrete, complex thoughts. You know, you pick up your book on organic chemistry or whatever, it's filled with complexity and it's utterly concrete. And it's not the same as abstract thinking whatsoever. But to think abstractly is a faculty, a triadal faculty, which human beings really need. And therefore, you know, we're being given the opportunity to stimulate that monastic permanent atom on the highest subplane of the normal mental plane, our normal solar or systemic plane. And that's part of the beauty and the purpose of this book. Now, there are many concretions, but the concretions are in a way so far beyond what we usually study that they have a kind of an abstract feel about them. And we're just going to learn more and more according to the science of relations about how the inner worlds are interconnected. And that will help us make those great generalizations which the abstract mind will offer us. So, you know, just stay with it. And as I say, by the year 2050, we'll be done with the book. But of course, then already DK's new dispensation will be coming out if we can just recognize it the way the Theosophical Society did not recognize Alice Bailey. We've got to recognize the new dispensation. It may not, probably is not going to come through the Lucis Trust at all or through anything that is presently existing. Just the way Alice Bailey, she had a loose affiliation with the Theosophical Society, but this new teaching came from her. So who will be the amanuensis for the new teaching? You already have a bunch of people aspiring to be the one, and they thereby disqualify themselves immediately, because ambition rules their motive. But it's coming, and the third in the set of bridging treatises is about to be released for humanity, and there's plenty to carry over to study what he already gave Alice Bailey, just the way we haven't stopped studying the secret doctrine, have we? Even though he gave it to Blavatsky long ago. And then we'll have a synthesis of all these spiritual gifts. I bet somebody else came up there, Michael, didn't they? Or am I imagining things? Okay, well then, I'm not particularly anxious if there's no one
Vera's hand is raised again.
Oh, Vera, okay.
Just looking at the screen, at the chart, which so many times we viewed, and I just noticed that the third aspect actually is not reaching the whole cosmic mental. It stops probably at the third sub-level. Supply?
Yes, here's how I look at it. The causal body of Earth is on the third subplane of the cosmic mental plane. The causal body of the sacred planets is on the second subplane of the cosmic mental plane. And the causal body of our solar logos and probably other solar logoi like it, and this is a little different from what goes on with us on the lower level, is on the first subplane of the cosmic mental plane. So in a way, the third aspect only reaches up through the fourth subplane on the cosmic physical plane. And that these cosmic mental plane. And that aspect is called Agni. When you're dealing with the personality of the solar logos, which is the lower 18 subplanes of the cosmic setup here, that's Agni. Well, that's one Agni anyway. So Agni is the personality of the solar logos. And of course, you know, you can imagine what it would be like to draw these charts out in full, and probably it wouldn't even be allowed, see? Because he, you know, in the normal, in this, basically, he doesn't go any higher than the third subplane down. Third subplane Buddhic, third subplane Atmic.
Yeah.
He doesn't even give us what's on the first and second subplane because he says you can't handle it and masters can't handle it. And then, even though you've got all of these monadic faculties going on up here? Wait a second. Hold on. Have I done this correctly? Yeah. Even though you have all these monadic faculties up here, they're so far beyond that he doesn't even bother to write anything down. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, over here, you know this chart from that Keith Bailey put together for AUM, Ancient, you know, Universal Mysteries. I'll, you know, again show you and show myself. There are all the faculties.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
But on the monadic plane, it doesn't even show it.
Yeah.
And on the atomic plane and the Buddhic plane, it only goes up to number 5 or down to number 3, and that's it.
Yeah.
So what's the use of trying to draw anything that has to do with the cosmic astral plane? Not only would it not be allowed, but probably DK couldn't do it. He says, what lies there, I do not know. I have not been there. So he's giving you a hint as to his own initiatory status. So look, you know, what it tells us is that there's a glorious future of knowledge leading to omniscience and to increased omnipresence and to higher and higher participation in what the divine will is trying to make happen. And that's a whole lot better than Bishop Usher and 4004 BC. But people resist, of course, you know what I mean. I read today that, you know, just to give you an example, that the man in the White House is telling his groups, his base, that his political opponent, Joe Biden, is against God and against the Bible. Okay, you know what I mean? This is so low.
Yeah.
When it comes to reality, it's a lot of these people are still believing 4004 BC was the beginning. And by the way, that the earth is flat and that all of the pictures that NASA has were simply doctored to fool us all.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So we, you know, in terms of ignorance, you can understand why Buddhists said, hey, ignorance is the big sin. Well, anyway, I didn't mean to bring up politics. It's in the air, you know, but it just has to do with a book like Cosmic Fire compared to the concrete conclusions that the universe appeared, and get this, at 9 o'clock in the morning in the year 4004 BC. I don't even know what month.
Mm-hmm.
The contradiction is jaw-dropping. But people hang on to it.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. Okay, thanks, sir. Okay, have we reached our point?
It appears so.
Okay, then okay, friends, then let's do I have the great invocation up there, Michael?
Yes, you do.
Right, well, I'm very happy that some of you have managed to survive. We didn't have a big group, but there are a lot of survivors, and that's very encouraging. Great invocation. From the point of light within the mind of God, let light stream forth into the minds of men. Let light descend on earth. from the point of love within the heart of God. Let love stream forth into the hearts of men. May Christ return to earth. From the center where the will of God is known, let purpose guide the little wills of men, the purpose which the masters know and serve. From the center which we call the race of men, let the plan of love and light work out, and may it seal the door where evil dwells. Let light and love and power restore the plan on earth. Okay, thank you everyone for being here. And tonight we continue with our glamour, dissipation of glamour at 5 p.m. GMT. And I guess there's enough glamour to go around, so we'll have something to talk about and watch these next 90 or so days. It's going to be an intensification of glamour such as we've probably never seen before in recent times. So hope to see some of you there then, and then we'll go on to the weekend. We're on the basically the evening schedule with the ASK programs, and we'll be broadcasting those. Okay, lots of love, many blessings from Tuya, myself, the whole communications team, Michael and Joe and BL and Michael Crow, well, you know, lots of people really helping out here to bring the discussions to you so you can go deeper and deeper and deeper into the teaching. We'll see you before long. Bye-bye.